This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Kansas State University professor Michael Wesch starts with a simple premise, according to his bio at National Geographic. All human relationships are mediated by communication. Change the medium of communication and you'll change the relationship, much as the printing press transformed the world 500 years ago. Dubbed The Explainer by Wired magazine, Michael Wesch is a cultural anthropologist exploring the effects of new media on society and culture. His videos on culture, technology, education, and information have been viewed over 20 million times, translated in over 20 languages, and are frequently featured at international film festivals and major academic conferences worldwide.
I spoke with Michael Wesch earlier this week, and I began by asking him, what does it mean to live in a mediated society?
Well, I think the best way to understand a mediated society is to try to understand what it would be like to live in an unmediated society. And so one way to do this would be just to sit in your own room and imagine the power turned off. And one thing you might realize is you'd immediately start to rearrange the furniture. Like right now, we arrange our furniture around the television, and you'd suddenly realize, it'd be better to arrange our furniture toward one another. And then you start pulling the layers back of all the different things that mediate us in some way, that in some way shape how we connect with one another. And these would be technologies that extend not just from communication technologies, but also even things like cars and transportation technologies also affect who we connect with and how we transport information and knowledge and so on. And once you start pulling those things away, then you start to realize that the whole way we built our cities would be changed and so on. So one of the things I did in my own life was I moved to New Guinea into a place, you know, that's virtually untouched and tried to experience what an unmediated society would look like. And I think there are a number of things that are kind of surprising. For example, while I was there, there was actually a new media form on the way, and that new media for them was not the internet or cell phones or anything like that. It was just simply writing. And writing came in the form of census books and law books. And the first census they did in the village was really interesting because a lot of the people they discovered actually did not have names. So they're asking for people's names. I mean, the census should be fairly simple. All you have to do is ask for people's names, list them in the book, and then you have a list of people in the village. But a lot of people didn't have names, and the reason why they didn't have names was because everybody they ever saw, they already knew. And so they actually had to invent a new word. They had to invent new names, and then the new word they used for these names was census name, which they borrowed from English. So if you were to go there today, and you wouldn't understand the language, of course, except for this one word, when you ask them for their name, you'd actually have to say census name, and they would then give you their name, which they actually don't use in their everyday life. It's just part of the census exercise. So I think it gives you a sense of just how deep media can shape us in different ways and make us think about ourselves in different ways when you start thinking about what it means to be unmediated.
Your premise is that all human relationships are mediated by communication. Change the medium of communication and you change the relationship. Tell us more about that.
Well, every medium shapes what can be said, how it can be said, who can say it, who can hear it, whether or not the messages and information will be stored, if it's stored, how it will be accessed later. And you start to add all these things up, and you actually have the basis for what is ultimately going to count as knowledge or what's going to count as important in a society. The easiest way to imagine the difference here is to think of the extremes. If you live in a network of societies that communicates through smoke signals versus a society that communicates through text messaging, for example, the things that you can say through smoke signals are different than what you can say through text messaging. Again, you could add books into this mix here, and the messages you can convey in a book are different than what you can convey in smoke signals or text messaging. Now, you know, our society is very complex and involves multiple media forms, and so it's harder to tease these things apart, but it's certainly true that when you add a new medium to this environment and it becomes important or dominant in people's lives, people recognize changes in their lives. And I suppose the most obvious one of our own times is the smartphone, which has come to be such an important part of so many people's lives. And there's sort of a paradox involved, because here, you know, I'm holding one in my hand right now, and it's potentially the most amazing knowledge machine ever invented. You know, if within it is access to more knowledge than has ever been held in any library, access to more people than any of my ancestors could have ever imagined reaching out to. And in that sense, it is like this great knowledge machine. But on the other hand, if I don't have any sense of curiosity or a sense of wonder about the world to use that knowledge machine, it becomes nothing more than a distraction device. It becomes also, while it's this great possibility to connect with others, we all know that the smartphone is also a very handy tool to disconnect with people around you. And so there are a number of paradoxes involved with any new technology, and any technology will, in a sense, cut in two ways.
What are the implications of internet society and the connecting force around the internet for people who have traditionally been marginalized? For example, people with mental health issues, people living in poverty, people who have been excluded from larger societal systems.
Well, I guess, you know, my last statement really makes a lot of sense here in the sense that it cuts two ways. On the one hand, our research has shown that people on the margins have often found a sense of community that they were lacking in their normal lives. And people who, for whatever reason, just felt on the outside of society were able to come online and find a whole number of other people who shared something with them. And sometimes the only thing they shared was a sense of being an outsider. But they could come online and feel a sense of very strong connection. And, you know, we spent years documenting these deep connections. And those are very heartwarming, and I think also you can tie them into some of the larger scale movements towards more openness and tolerance in society. But at the same time, there's this other counter trend and another possibility, and that is that sometimes people with mental health issues, for example, young women with anorexia, they get on forums together and they call them pro-ana groups, and they share messages about how they can essentially stay anorexic, and they encourage each other to starve themselves and do whatever they can to become even thinner yet. So in that sense, it can work in sort of a negative light. It brings these people together and they get to share the sense of community, but at the expense of their health. And the other thing I would add here is, you know, while the internet can bring people together, it does so in a mediated way. And, you know, it depends on how the forum or whatever the website is set up. A website can actually, in many ways, encourage negative and bad behavior just in the way that it's set up. For example, the YouTube comment system, they've tried to correct this for quite some time, but it's really kind of set up for hate comments to proliferate. And they've tried to tame this a little bit by putting, you know, thumbs down and thumbs up rating systems on it. So when you see a hate-based comment, you can flag it or you can give it a thumbs down, and eventually those things disappear. But the nature of the comments on YouTube itself, in a way, encourages bad behavior in some cases.
One of the approaches you use in teaching at Kansas State University is directed at dispelling myths, revealing how complicated our world's problems are. It's called world simulation. How does it work?
I'm faced with the really big challenge of teaching 400 students at once, and it's the topic is anthropology, which is study of all humans in all times and all places. And about midway through my first semester teaching it, I realized that what was so powerful for me when I took the class was that I ended up leaving the class not with a lot of answers, but with a lot of questions. And those questions were what guided my life in many ways. I started to realize just how important the questions were as opposed to the answers. And yet here I was giving these multiple choice exams, which are, you know, just encouraging students to memorize answers. So I actually stopped halfway through the semester my very first year teaching, and I thought, maybe I should just pay attention to the questions they're asking. Like, are they actually even contemplating the really big questions that I'm thinking about and that I want them to think about? And so I stopped to listen, and the questions they were asking were things like, how many points is this worth? What's going to be on the test? You know, things like that. And those are obviously not very good questions. So then I thought, well, how could we get them to focus on the big questions that matter? And so I decided to throw out the rest of the syllabus. And I just went in one day and I just, you know, asked them to really contemplate the state of the world right now. And we gathered statistics together. We sort of did a crowdsourcing collaboration where we tried to just pull back the curtains on the world and see what the world looks like. And then we thought, well, let's see if we could figure out why the world is the way it is. So, you know, some of the stats we would find are things, you know, like all the stats you always hear, like, you know, half the world making less than $2 a day, and, you know, 27,000 children will die of poverty today. And the question then is why? And so we thought, well, let's try to map all the different processes that go on here. And to do that, let's create kind of a game or a simulation. And so the students actually then study different theories, but in the reason why they're studying these theories is to ultimately make a game that's actually pretty fun. And the way it works out is we spread out all over campus, all 400 students. They each represent different cultures. Sometimes we kind of make it a fake world. Sometimes we make it the real world. And then we basically create very simple rules of trade and diplomacy and war and so on. And you let this thing play out for a couple hours and you see what happens. And ultimately, you know, some people end up exploiting others. Some people end up in slavery. We even end up with, sometimes you have genocides, all kinds of really terrible things that have happened throughout world history. And here students actually get to see some of the processes at work that create those things. They get to see some of the contradictions and paradoxes at the core of our global system that can create so much wealth and high living standards for some while others are still suffering. And in a way, just to see it all unfold in just an hour or two is really just a great conversation starter more than anything. It's not that the game itself provides answers, and that's the whole point. It provides a new set of questions those very questions that I hope burn in their souls forever, something that they contemplate over and over again throughout their lives.
Is it becoming increasingly impossible to opt out of internet or web-based life? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think it is. I don't know that there is an option to opt out anymore, and you could think of this at many levels. Even at a young age, you know, as kids are turning 11 or 12 years old, many of them feel like they need a smartphone, and they'll come to their parents and ask for a smartphone. And if they don't get it, they feel like they're being cut out of their, you know, their little society of friends, because their friends are coming home from school immediately, you know, communicating through Snapchat or text or Facebook or whatever it might be. Connected in some way to the mobile device. And if they don't get it, they're cut out of that of that social life. And that analogy holds true, of course, for all of us, and regardless of where we're at in our lives. It's just basically so many of our colleagues, people we interact with through our businesses or whatever it is that we're doing, not to mention friends and family, are all connected through these devices. So if you're not there, essentially you're just, you're in a way literally not there. It's almost as if these places, and I speak metaphorically here of places like Facebook and so on, Facebook is in a way it's like the world's largest public space ever invented. And if you're not on Facebook, then you're not actually entering this huge public space where all these people are gathering, and you're kind of missing something. I think you can opt out of something like Facebook, but the idea of opting out of all of it is would be much more difficult. It would mean opting out of a great deal of society. It's just become so enmeshed with society itself that it becomes very difficult to opt out. Now, all that said, I think it's even all the more important to be very sophisticated about and have a good understanding about how these media affect us, how they change how we think and how we connect with one another, and ultimately to have the capacity not just to manage which media we use at different times in our lives, but also to know when it's time to turn it all off, to have a moment of contemplation, or to know when it's to have the courage. I say it's not just a matter of knowledge. It's not just have the courage to use the right medium at the right time, and and oftentimes that's going to mean like a really hard face-to-face talk with somebody, rather than, sort of running away from a problem by just, emailing them or texting them or something like that. These technologies are very seductive in that way, in that they all give us kind of an easy way out of all kinds of challenging things in our lives. And the more we take that easy way out, the less strong our connections become. And we become increasingly isolated and so on. A lot of this has to do with just how vulnerable we're going to allow ourselves to be. And if we don't embrace our vulnerability and really reach out and put our soul on the line with people, we will never feel a sense of true connection with others. And instead, we're going to sort of drift through life in feeling a sense of isolation or feeling a sense of innocent. I mean, that ultimately comes down to a sense of meaninglessness, that you just, our sense of meaning and joy come from experiencing things deeply with others. And that's the problem with these technologies, in the sense that they give us a seductive way out.
Michael Wesch, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Michael Wesch is a cultural anthropologist and professor at Kansas State University. You can find him online at michaelwesch.com. That's WESCH.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with the Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.